Anti-government protests have rattled Sudan after the government tripled the price of a loaf of bread. But there are credible reports that Sudanese security forces have shot dead 37 protesters. In this edition of The Debate, we will discuss Sudan's future, the protests, surely the biggest challenge to its president, Omar al-Bashir, who has promised reforms. But are the reforms a little too late? Stay tuned to find out.
It all started after the Sudanese government announced plans to raise the price of bread last week. Since then, protests and clashes between police and demonstrators have shown no signs of abating. The protests, which initially were held over rising prices and shortages of food and fuel, have expanded into calls for President Omar al-Bashir to resign. The government has responded by insisting that the significant subsidies on bread prices will not be lifted. But the move failed to calm down angry protesters. Bashir has pledged to introduce measures to fix the economy and provide citizens with what he described as a dignified life. He also warned citizens against what he called rumor mongers and incitement. Curfews have been imposed and a state of emergency has been declared in several Sudanese cities while security forces have been deployed across the country. Amnesty International claims that the death toll is much more than the official figures announced by the government. Sporadic protests also broke out in January this year over the rising cost of food, but they were soon brought under control with the arrest of opposition leaders and activists. Sudan had significant oil reserves until South Sudan gained independence in 2011. The country lost three-quarters of its reserves after the South split. This made the cost of some commodities rise dramatically in Sudan, where inflation is already running close to 70%, and the country's currency has plunged in value, putting more pressure on the ordinary Sudanese who feel desperate to make ends meet.
Our guest joining us for this edition of The Debate, African Affairs expert Lawrence Freeman, joins us from Baltimore. We have publisher at Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofeanansa, who joins us from London. Gentlemen, welcome. Lawrence Freeman, let me first start with you and get your reaction on how possibly 37 protesters may be to have been killed, protests to have reached the capital at this point by some accounts nationwide, initially to have begun over rising bread costs.
It's impossible for me to know how many people have actually been killed. However, the crisis is very serious, possibly the most serious challenge to President Omar al-Bashir's regime in many years. The problem is, which I've addressed to many of my Sudanese friends, is they're following the dictates of the IMF and World Bank policies, which say that for Sudan to become a good member in good standing of the international financial community and possibly get forgiveness on its debt, they have to carry out brutal austerity measures, removing subsidies, devaluation of the currency. And this, of course, is leading to legitimate anger and protest over these economic conditions. But my recommendation to my friends and to the government was to break from these IMF, World Bank debt policies and embark on a national policy of economic development. And that's the only way to stop the protests that are right now threatening and destabilizing the whole nation.
Do you agree with that, Jonathan Ofeanansa? How is the government going to deal with this? Break away from the IMF and go with its own national plan, or stick with IMF and impose austerity, which obviously we could see what the consequences of that is?
Well, as things stand now, Omar Bashir and his government have no alternative, than to, abide by the IMF conditions. But having said that, they will need to introduce some measures, right, to ameliorate, the social impacts of any adjustments that they are going to undertake, under the IMF conditions.
Well, Lawrence Freeman, these are not the first protests that have broken out. They broke out in the beginning, in January.
Yes.
And also, I believe, back in 2013. And back in 2013, there were also deaths that occurred. What has prolonged or kept it at bay, and then for it to happen again. Now, this being the third time around, which you say is a big threat to Omar al-Bashir.
I was in Sudan at the time of the 2013 protests, and what happens is that the people respond, then there's certain countermeasures taken, and then things remain quiet for a while, and then you see another eruption, and then when the eruption occurs, it gains momentum. Now, there is an alternative, which is the working with China on the One Belt, One Road. This has brought massive infrastructure development, the first time since colonialism, in many countries, Nigeria, Ethiopia, Kenya, and others. With Sudan needs, I've been visiting Sudan for almost a quarter of a century. They desperately need energy. They need high-speed rail. They need roads. They need jobs to build their agriculture and their natural resources, which are many. They haven't done this, and they've been conditioned and bludgeoned and threatened that if they don't work with the IMF and World Bank, there'll be no solution, no relief to their $56 billion of debt. When South Sudan split, which I was opposed to, obviously it took 75% of their oil wealth, but even so, the government has not made the full commitment to developing the country and improving the standard of living and its people. And until it does that, it is in danger. Now, I believe there's people on the ground that are using legitimate protest and frustration to channel it into regime change. And I warn my friends that this would happen because for the last 25 years, regime change has not worked against President al-Bashir. And so they would move towards economic policies being used to promote a regime change. And this, I believe, is what some people have in mind and are using these demonstrations today to carry out.
Jonathan Ansah, one of the things, when you began speaking, I think you questioned even the legitimacy of Omar al-Bashir. If I'm incorrect, please let me know. Because we've seen these protests turned from their economic hardships and focus now on Omar al-Bashir himself. People seems, at least the ones out on the streets, that they don't want his rule. He obviously has tried to extend his presidential term limits. He does have his backing. Do you think that people want him therefore removed? And if so, where is this going to lead?
Yeah, definitely. Because, look, the problems are not just economic. They are twofold. They are political reasons, you know, underlying, you know, the economic problems. Look, there is massive corruption in the country. You know, I mean, high government officials, you know, party officials, assessing, sourcing bank loans and not repaying them, right? Some high-ranking officials hoarding foreign currency at home, and so on and so forth. So, I mean, the problem is twofold, economic and political, right? And I believe that before the economic could be resolved, the political problem needs to be addressed. So the people have seen this. That is why they are demanding the removal of al-Bashir. Because look, the opposition has been cowed into submission. It's ineffective, right? The security agencies, you know, are always at play, right? Nipping any opposition in the mud. Nipping any opposition in the bud, right? That is why the people, you know, are embarking on this, can I say, unrest, right, to demand al-Bashir's removal.
We need to talk maybe a little bit here, Lawrence Freeman, about the secession that happened and how it affected Sudan and what the deal is, because many perhaps are not aware about the way that the oil actually belongs to South Sudan for the most part, but it has to transit through to Sudan. Was this the beginning of Sudan's economic woes?
It certainly exacerbated them. Sudan began to sell oil in 1998, I believe. I was in a conference there in Sudan on this subject. And they should have used the oil money to build the infrastructure in the south and the north of Sudan. They did build the Merowe Dam, which was 1.2 gigawatts of power, which I visited, but they had to do a lot more and they did not. The government of Sudan was threatened by George Bush 43's presidency that if they did not go ahead with the Comprehensive Peace Agreement of 2005, that they would be completely isolated, destroyed, and the government would be overthrown. So President Bashir signed the document to allow a vote to occur to separate the two Sudans. I didn't think that was a good move, but they felt threatened and they had to do it. And with that, then the vote was taken in 2011, July, South Sudan became a separate country. Now, there were people in Britain and the United States who wanted to use the separation of South Sudan to bring down Khartoum. And they really didn't care at all about the welfare of the South Sudanese people. I opposed it because I didn't think the structure was there for a government. And unfortunately, I was right. South Sudan has imploded. It's a complete disaster. South Sudan, Khartoum, is necessary for any solution to South Sudan. If you were to overthrow President Bashir, you would get probably someone far more conservative and a person less inclined to work with the West, and you'd have more destabilization in the North and South Sudan. So I don't think that's a viable alternative. I think even the opposition has to put forth a comprehensive solution, alternative program for the development of the country to improve the welfare of the 40 million people. And they haven't done that either. Now, the government of Sudan and I have disagreed on many things, and they have not acted the way I think they should have and taken my advice. But I don't see overthrowing the government is going to not only will not make things better, it will make things worse.
Well, Jonathan Wayansa, why is the West, in particular the UK and the U.S., why were they so interested in Sudan in the first place? I mean, in terms of the U.S., there were three successive U.S. presidents who had been pushing to make Sudan a foreign policy priority. And, of course, we saw what happened when the U.K. also came into the picture. Maybe that was a priority for them, too. Why was Sudan such a big deal for them?
Yes, let me allude to what Lawrence said earlier on. You see, when there was only one Sudan, you know, North and South was one country, I mean, there were a lot of, a massive Chinese investment in the oil sector. And I believe, right, that is what, you know, the UK and the US were not happy about. Even right now, they are very nervous of the increasing Chinese economic influence in Africa. And they saw it at that time that with the increased investment in the Sudanese oil industry, the Chinese influence would increase. So they had to act, right, to nip that in the bud. Okay, so the nervousness of UK and the US all boils down to the Chinese element, and again, I think some engagement with the Russians as well.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that Chinese element there too. But let's bring in another actor into the picture here, Lawrence Freeman, and that is Saudi Arabia. When the aside from the oil prices going down, and then you had the secession that happened, you had Saudi Arabia that actually came to the aid of Sudan. One of the first agreements they had was this 5-year oil agreement. I'm not too sure if that actually transpired, but it was supposed to give. Energy for Sudan. Of course, part of the agreement to that was that Sudan was to provide fighters for the war on Yemen. Is Saudi Arabia going to pursue Sudan? We understand also that Qatar has shown support or has voiced interest in Sudan. Can you tell us their function?
Well, Saudi Arabia moved very quickly to help Sudan. They did give some substantial amounts of money. However, you may remember that Sudan had then carried out a complete reversal and had been allies with Iran and then now switched and became close allies with Saudi Arabia. And I believe wrongly supported Saudi Arabia and has supported Saudi Arabia with forces to fight in Yemen. This is not a long-term solution. The Saudis have their own geopolitical interests. And I don't think that the solution for Sudan is to ally itself strictly with Sudan or Khartoum. I think there's a big movement, a new paradigm that's developing, which we see with China to a great extent. That's why the United States policy on the National Security Advisor, John Bolton, attacked China and attacked Russia. China, to a great extent, other countries are developing Africa for the first time since colonialism. The Western countries haven't done anything, nothing in this area. So they're not really going to provide a solution either. So Sudan has to ally with neighbors of its own, neighbors of friends internationally, and really get about building their economy. The problem is that they don't have this, they've not fully understood that the how to go about this and the necessity, like their neighbor Ethiopia has. And therefore, this is where the big problem lies in the government. But there's no about bailouts or aid or loans that's going to solve this problem. If you've been to Sudan, as I have many times, there's extreme poverty, people are underemployed and unemployed, and therefore there's got to be a massive reconstruction development program. Otherwise, no matter who the ruler is, the Sudanese people will continue to suffer.
Okay, the role of China was mentioned, and we'd like to talk about that more, Jonathan Ofeansa. And we know that in South Sudan, for example, the U.S. and China have been in competition. But we have seen what has happened in South Sudan. Also, there's a presence of Israel there, which maybe you can explain that to us. But if you can tell us to what extent will the U.S. go if it's just a matter of competition? And as our guest Lawrence Freeman said, that the U.S. at one point, if they're still maybe on that path, wanted to bring down Khartoum. But then explain to us then why sanctions were lifted, because that then wouldn't be in line with that.
Yeah, in fact, I am surprised when the U.S. lifted sanctions on Sudan last year. And I cannot, at this point, explain why the U.S. did that. Maybe it did that maybe to still, as part of its countermeasures against Chinese influence. But having said that, I mean, Sudan is still on the list of the U.S. list of state sponsors of terrorism. So until Sudan is removed from that list, I don't see any progress being made by Sudan in terms of raising multilateral finance and so on and so on and so forth. But I'm surprised. I was surprised when U.S. lifted those sanctions on Sudan last year. And to me, the sanctions, the lift of the sanctions hasn't yielded any benefits so far.
Maybe Lawrence Freeman has an answer for that. Why do you think the U.S. lifted those sanctions, Lawrence Freeman?
Well, the sanctions they lifted were limited, partial. And I think the reason they did it was twofold. One is the United States and Great Britain are responsible for the genocide going on in South Sudan. And therefore, and the only that there's no solution, none possible in South Sudan without working with North Sudan. And in fact, President Bashir signed his name to the Comprehensive Peace Agreement in 2005. So for any solution in South Sudan, they needed Sudan. Two, as my colleague on the other end referenced, the shift in the United States became more towards counterintelligence and security. And Sudan actually, I believe, I could be wrong, I think has the largest or one of the largest CIA complexes in Africa. Because they, if you look across the water, you're looking at Arabia, you're looking at Reds. If you look to the south, you see Somalia is not too far away. So they wanted to use, and Sudan extends into the Sahara Desert. So they wanted to use Sudan as a security counterintelligence ally, but they have not taken any measures that will actually help Sudan or its people. And see, this is the problem from all the U.S. administrations. Going back, the last one that did anything for Africa was John F. Kennedy, who collaborated with Kwame Nkrumah to build the Volta Dam project. The U.S. will not develop. It's just stated policy. Stated policy. We don't do development. We don't do infrastructure. China does. So this recent policy by John Bolton and all the previous U.S. policies attacking China, they're impotent because nothing's going to stop China and African countries from working together, or Russia, working with Russia, or India, or Turkey.
Right.
The U.S. is complaining but it's not doing anything. So they're focusing on security and counterintelligence, but if, unless you have development, you can't really solve security measures, which we're seeing in North Africa. Okay. So the U.S. position is rather impotent at this point and won't solve any problems.
30 seconds to each of you. Jonathan, so what are we looking at when we are looking at Sudan? Where is this going to be going? 30 seconds.
Well, I believe the massive security apparatus is going to nip this protest at the bud.
And Lawrence Freeman, 30 seconds, same question.
Well, they're certainly going to try, but there clearly are Western agents on the ground trying to engineer this towards regime change against Bashir and the National Congress Party, and I'm fearful about Sudan's future.
Okay, we're going to have to end it there. Thank you very much, African Affairs expert Lawrence Freeman, and thank you, publisher at Africa Briefing, Jonathan Ofeanza. Thanks for tuning in to another edition of The Debate. From We Cover Tabwa, entire team in the capital, Tehran, it's goodbye.
Sorry, Sudan.